concerns both events that are still future, as well as it is confirmed by events that have already taken place. They are prophesied, they've taken place. It gives us a lot of solid confirmation in the truth of prophecy. Now, in our study of the first part of this chapter last week, we were given insights into the character of Daniel himself as a man who had a true heart of prayer. You may recall that he was studying Jeremiah 25, and Jeremiah 25 talks about the prophecy concerning Jerusalem being desolate for 70 years. Now, by this time, it's the first year of the reign of Darius the Mede, Daniel is an old man, and he realizes this 70 years has got to have been fulfilled. And if that's fulfilled, then how is all this going to play out? And so that prompts him to pray. We also found that Daniel had a great identification with his people. And though he was a righteous man, he identified with the sin of his people and declares that God is just and righteous in his condemnation and all the calamity had taken place. And so that was part of his prayer as well. In fact, about three-quarters of the prayer is confession. And then we found that Daniel responded to all that with supplication. He wanted to see that Israel would go back to the land, the temple would be rebuilt, and God's name would yet again be glorified in that place, in his people, even as Jeremiah had prophesied in Jeremiah 29. In Daniel 9:20-21, we find that Daniel receives an answer, and in fact, it comes and Gabriel is sent while Daniel's still praying. So look there at verse 20. Now while I was speaking and praying and confessing my sin and the sin of my people Israel and presenting my supplication before the Lord my God in behalf of the holy mountain of my God, while I was still speaking in prayer, then the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision previously, came to me in my extreme weariness about the time of the evening offering, which would have been about 3 to 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Now Daniel had met Gabriel some 12 or 13 years earlier when he had explained the vision God had given Daniel concerning the ram and the goat. That was Daniel chapter 8. In Luke 1:19, Gabriel identifies himself to Mary as the one who stands in the presence of God. So we understand this is an angel. He's appeared in the form of a man and has been sent by the Lord in answer to Daniel's prayer. Gabriel then explains to Daniel his purpose in coming in the next couple verses. Look at verse 22. And he gave me instruction and talked with me and said, O Daniel, I have now come forth to give you insight with understanding. At the beginning of your supplications, the command was issued, and I've come to tell you, for you are highly esteemed, so give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. So Gabriel is sent to Daniel at the beginning of his supplication, and the particular task he has is to give Daniel insight with understanding concerning, it says, the vision. Well, what vision is Gabriel talking about? Recall at the end of the vision of the four beasts in Daniel 7 that Daniel is left greatly alarmed. In fact, it says his face grew pale, but he kept the matter to himself. He had a similar reaction with the vision of the ram and the goat in Daniel 8. He was exhausted. He was sick for days and didn't understand how this was supposed to be played out. But there was no further explanation. As Daniel is reading through Jeremiah's prophecy concerning the 70 years of desolation for Jerusalem, the temple, he understands that, yes, those 70 years are about to end. He knows Jeremiah 29, there is supposed to be a restoration of the land. But how does that fit with the visions he had? It doesn't make sense to him. He is confused. The vision of the beast goes far beyond the restoration of Jerusalem, and that seems imminent, but there's stuff that goes on past that. There seems to be further tribulation and more desolation of Jerusalem according to the visions he had. So how do these things fit together? Now you understand more of why he's prodded so much to be praying. Is, in his mind, it's going to be, is God going to delay this restoration? Since he's had these visions, are they not going to be able to go back to land? And that's why his prayer was so diligent, with so much emphasis and passion in it. And Gabriel's purpose then is to explain to Daniel, because he is highly esteemed, how these things fit together. Now, Gabriel tells Daniel, give heed to the message and gain understanding of the vision. So we're going to end up being forced back into Daniel 7, because that's where the vision is. And we want to gain an understanding as well. So follow along as I read Gabriel's explanation, verses 24 through 27, and then we're going to come back and look at each verse in detail. Verse 24, 70 weeks have been decreed for your people and your holy city to finish the transgression, to make an end of sin, to make atonement for iniquity, to bring in everlasting righteousness, to seal up vision and prophecy, and to anoint the most holy place. So you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah the Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks. It will be built again with plaza and moat, even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off and have nothing. And the people of the Prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary. And its end will come with a flood, even to the end there will be war. Desolations are determined. And he will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now, the first thing is determining the length of time. Verse 24 gives an overview statement about what's going to be explained in more detail in the verses that will be following. And Gabriel states these things are going to be accomplished over, our English translation says, 70 weeks. Well, what are these 70 weeks? We get a little confused by that because in English we take the term weeks and always think that means 7 days. And so we're wondering, what is this talking about? But the reference here, the term here in Hebrew, Shabuah, is simply a reference to seven, a unit of seven, or we might call that a heptad. But the question is seven what? It's a unit of seven somethings. Is it 7 days? Is it 7 weeks? 7 months? 7 years? Seven what? How do we determine that? Well, we can go back into the context. In the near context, what prompted Daniel to pray? He was reading about the 70 years that Jerusalem was going to be left desolate. So the near context says years. Next, we examine what the 70 years was about. And this is interesting because the 70 years of desolation is directly related to the 70 years, sabbatical years, that had not been kept by Israel. That is why it's 70 years of desolation. In order to get 70 sabbatical years, it takes 490 years. That's 70 sevens. 2 Chronicles 36, 21, Leviticus 26, 34 make it very clear this is the reason for the 70 years of desolation. And Daniel would have been very aware of that. Third, the many things that Gabriel states have to be accomplished during this period are going to take a lot longer than anything provided by less than years. 490 days is not long enough, a little year and a half or so. If it's weeks, that's only 9.5 years. If it's months, it's nearly 41 years. But during this period, the temple has to be rebuilt. Jerusalem has to be rebuilt. The Messiah has to come. The Messiah has to be cut off. And the city and the sanctuary have to be destroyed again. And then fourth, because we live when we do, we can look back historically and we find a confirmation. He was referring to weeks of years. So it's 77-year periods. That's what he's talking about. I also need to point out that later on when we do some computation on this, we're looking at a Jewish year. And it, like many of the ancient calendars, were fixed on a 360-day calendar, not 365 and about a quarter. In fact, if you compare Daniel's reference in 725 of times and half a time, 3.5 years, with the 42 months and 1,260 days that are in Revelation 11, 13, and 12, you find that there's a confirmation of this usage. They had a 30-day month on average, and that's how it was being calculated. And we'll get into some of that a little later on. But it's not the same year as we're thinking of it. We use a different calendar. They had a very different calendar than us. Now, the decree itself encompasses a total of 70 weeks during which many specific things are going to have to take place. What are these things? Well, the first one, let's figure out who it's talking to. What is the scope of this decree? It specifically, the text states, to your people and your holy city. Who is Gabriel talking to? Daniel. Who are Daniel's people? Jews. What city? It's Jerusalem. Okay, this is the scope of it. The 70 weeks concerns the people of Israel, the Jewish people, in the city of Jerusalem. It's simply wrong to read the church back in this passage, and yet you'll find in a lot of commentaries that is done. They want to think somehow the church is involved here. And while the events that we're going to look at will certainly have an effect on the church, which is yet future from this passage, the church is not in view. The church is nowhere in the passage. It concerns the Jewish nation and Jerusalem, not the church. Now, Gabriel lists out six specific things that God has determined are going to be accomplished during these 70 weeks of years. The first is finish the transgression. The transgression refers to the rebellion of God's chosen people. And this was the reason for the desolation of Jerusalem, the destruction of the temple in the first place, wasn't it? They were in rebellion against God. And God had warned them that this was going to happen if they were in rebellion, and he simply had taken forth and held to his word and brought it to pass. They were in rebellion. Paul explains in Romans 11 that at the present time there is still a partial hardening among the Jewish nation, and that it's going to remain that way until the fullness of the Gentiles comes in. However, after all that is mentioned here in Daniel 9 is completed, they will cease their rebellion. Daniel prayed for God to restore Israel, and that prayer is going to be fulfilled, both in the near future for Daniel, because there is a remnant that's going to go back, the temple will be rebuilt, and in the distant future, when the transgression itself will be completely done. There will be no more rebellion. Second is to make an end of sins, or actually it's sins, it's plural here. Transgression is an open rebellion against God, while sin is a failure to do God's will. One is active, the other can be passive. But when the root of rebellion is dealt with, you also take care of sin, don't you? Sin is brought to final judgment, and it's then taken away. And so Daniel's request for God's wrath to be turned away from Jerusalem and its people is going to be eventually fulfilled. Third is to make an atonement for iniquity. This is the work which enables the transgression to be finished and the sins to come to an end. Now, the system of animal sacrifices was all in an effort to atone for sin. And you remember that got started back in Genesis 3. Adam and Eve had sinned. They recognized that they were naked, and God killed animals and took their skins and clothed Adam and Eve. That word there for clothing them is the same word for atone. He covered it over. He covered their shame, which was demonstrating their sinfulness. But as Hebrews 10:4 says, the blood of bulls and goats could never take away sins. They're not sufficient. An animal is not the equivalent of a human. There was going to have to be some future sacrifice that would be sufficient to deal with the problem of iniquity. And Daniel prayed the Lord would forgive his people and that God would do that in the future. Paul states in Romans 11:26 that all Israel will be saved. And then he quotes Isaiah 59 that God is going to take away their sins. It is going to happen. It's going to happen within these 70 weeks. Fourth is bringing in an everlasting righteousness. This is the positive work of God during this time. Not only is the sin problem taken care of, but righteousness is established. And that's so much better, isn't it? Not only is there no sin, but righteousness is immeasurably better. And it's immeasurably better than all the revivals that have taken place during the history of Israel. And there had been many of them, like under Josiah, but they're always short-lived. Even at best, they tend to be half-hearted among the people. They still want to go up to the high places and worship. But here, it's going to be an everlasting righteousness. Interestingly enough, Jeremiah has prophecies concerning that. In Jeremiah 23, 5 and 6, he talks about the righteous branch, the Messiah, who will establish David's throne eternally. He talks about in Jeremiah 31 a prophecy of a new covenant by which God is going to place it on the hearts of the people to do righteousness. So Daniel's prayer is going to be fulfilled. The people in the city would again become fitting to be called by God's name. Next is to seal up the vision and prophecy. This is the result of these things being fulfilled. The visions given to Daniel, the prophecies within them are going to be confirmed. They will be fulfilled. And after they're all fulfilled, they come to their end, don't they? Once the prophecy is fulfilled, there's nothing left of it. You just look back on it and see a confirmation. And there won't be a need for similar prophecies after that. And then to anoint the most holy, or literally to anoint a holy of holies, appears to be a reference to the consecration of the temple complex in Jerusalem at the beginning of the millennial reign. Ezekiel 40 through 48 covers all that. And Daniel would have been aware of that. Remember, Ezekiel is a prophet, just a little younger than Daniel, who's actually there in Babylon with him. Now that's an overview. That's what's going to happen during these 70 weeks of years. Now Gabriel starts breaking it down and gives him better explanation of particular things during particular parts of these 70 years. Verse 25 is next, and we find there's going to be a restoration. There is going to be a decree to rebuild Jerusalem. That's the first event that's going to take place. But there are four different decrees in Scripture that have been put forth as being possibly the one that's being referred to here. But the decree is very specific. The decree includes rebuilding this with plaza and moat. Jerusalem with plaza and moat, or a New King James says street and wall. Now the Hebrew here is a little bit difficult. Hebrew tends to be a little difficult because it's often understood more by context. The word itself can have a variety of meanings. But here the Hebrew word rakab refers to either streets or the open spaces behind the city gates where commerce takes place. The streets are open. You can get through them. So that's what's being referred to that. Then the Hebrew word karatz is variously translated as either a wall or a trench. It's referring to the defensive aspects of before the city, because usually you build a wall and then you dig a trench in front of it that heightens the wall. And that gives you greater defense. So what's being referred to is that Jerusalem, the city, is going to be rebuilt. They can, again, you know, move around in it, have commerce, and it's going to be a defended city again. Now, of the decrees that are given, the first one was Cyrus's. It came in 538 BC. It's recorded in Ezra 1, 1 and 2. But that decree only concerns rebuilding the temple. It says nothing about Jerusalem. The second decree is Darius's decree. It comes in 519 BC. It's recorded in Ezra 6, 1. But all that decree does is confirm Cyrus's decree. A third decree was made by Artaxerxes in 457 BC. That's recorded in Ezra 7:11. But it also only concerned the temple, the things that would go into the temple, and it also included allowing the magistrates, judges, to be appointed so the law could be carried out. It actually says nothing about Jerusalem itself. The last decree, and there's debate whether this is 444 or 445 BC, is recorded in Nehemiah 2. And this is Artaxerxes giving Nehemiah permission, in fact, the command, to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the walls, to make it a defensive city. That is the one that we're looking at. That's the one that fits what Gabriel said this decree would entail. Now, he also says there's a beginning point, that's this decree, and there's an ending point. When will that be? Well, the terminus period is a total of 7 weeks of years plus 62 weeks of years for a total of 483 years, 69 weeks. Now, nothing indicates why these 69 years are broken up to two periods within the text, nor other places in Scripture. But it is reasonable to suggest that the first period may be the amount of time it took to rebuild the city, 49 years. Now, that seems reasonable because when we read Nehemiah, we find that when Nehemiah gets there, what's the condition of the city? It's a mess. It's not just the walls are broken down, the gates are burned. He can't even get through the streets to get to where the walls are supposed to be. It's that much of a mess. And if you've read Nehemiah lately, you know that through the whole time, he has constant opposition. In fact, for a while, they have to have their swords strapped onto them and some standing with spears because those around them are threatening to come and harm them. You know, it takes a little longer to build if you have extra weight on you and you can't use both hands. So it would have taken a long time, but we don't have anything recorded about exactly how long that take. Now, it's possible, but it's speculation that perhaps this first 7 weeks of years is simply the length of time for rebuilding Jerusalem. Now, I need to say that calculating ancient dates becomes very confusing. I don't think you've tried to do that. The more you get into it, the more confusing it gets, and especially so if you're trying to use an ancient Hebrew calendar. The reason for this is that the Jewish calendar was lunar-based. It wasn't until, I forgot what year it was, it's like in the 500s or something, that they put it as a lunar-solar thing where it's now calculated. Before, it was always sort of, we're waiting until we can see the first crescent moon. When we see the first crescent moon, then it is announced that this is the first of the month. Now, how would you like to be planning that way? Okay? Now, if it's a cloudy day and you don't see it, it means the month is one day longer. If they know that it's the second day was cloudy, they know it could not have been, it has to have been visible by now. You might not have seen it yesterday, but it's got to be visible by now. So you start that even though that's the 31st day of the previous month, it now becomes the first day of the current month. Do you like that? And then you send runners out to tell everybody, by the way, today is the first of the month. Now imagine what it's like trying to figure out going backwards about what day you're talking about. Okay, that's one of the complications. Then you also get to have fun with the Gregorian calendar and the Julian calendar. And then these are coordinated with things like the Egyptian calendar, the Babylonian calendar. And then you get to figure out trying things as they say the first year or the second year of so-and-so. Or are they counting it from the point of when he starts his reign, or is it the first year after? For example, at what point are you 1 year old? After your first birthday, right? At what point are you in your first year? Before your first birthday, okay? That's the way it works. I am currently 53 years old. I passed the 53-year mark, but I'm in my 54th year. Does that make sense? All right. Now try and do that calendars and going backwards and figuring all that out, going past multiple kingdoms, and it gets confusing. So if there's some fudge factor here, that's why. It gets really confusing. But I will throw these things out because these are the more interesting ones I came across. One guy using 457 as a starting date and using solar years, 365 and a quarter days long, if he uses that, he calculates that he ends up in AD 27 and says, that's a possibility for Jesus' baptism. Okay, maybe. That actually has a conflict there with when we think Jesus started his ministry, but that's a possibility. Now, Nehemiah 2:1 states that Artaxerxes' second decree, which includes rebuilding the temple walls, or the walls of Jerusalem, was made in the month of Nisan. Now, there's debate whether that's Nisan would be March-April in our calendar. There's a lot of debate whether this is March 445 B.C., Sir Robert Anderson had calculated that date, or is it 444 B.C., Dr. Harold Honer uses that date. And it's interesting reading the discussions if you like these kinds of things. I do, so I was fascinated and spent a couple days reading this stuff and not getting my sermon done. Now, they both use a prophetic calendar, which I mentioned before is 360 days, because the Jewish calendar officially is 360 days, which to me is very interesting, because a lot of ancient calendars were 360 days, which in my speculative mind means, was the earth rotating faster before the flood? So it actually was 360 days. And with the flood, we have more friction, and we've slowed down a little bit. So now we're 365, and it's 0.24 something or other. I don't know. But they had a 360-day calendar, okay? It was different than ours. Using that, they calculate the end point ends up as possible dates for Jesus' triumphal entry into Jerusalem. That'd be either AD 32 or 33. Now, both are possible, and there's a lot of debate about which one it is, because which one would end up with the crucifixion on a Friday, but it's hard to tell which year actually had a Friday, Nisan 14. So that gets interesting, too, and you have a lot of fun doing that. But either date is possible, AD 32 or 33, and that fits well with something else that tells us about the calendar. We know from Luke 3, 1 and 2, 21, 23, there's a reference to Jesus beginning his ministry in the 15th year of Tiberius' reign. And that'd be AD 28 or 29. So if that's the beginning of his ministry, we know there's three or four Passovers, and there's debate about that too. That puts you at AD 32 or 33 for his triumphal entry and the crucifixion. So the numbers can work out. Harold Honer works it out to the very day of March 30th, AD 33, and that's the day that Jesus comes into Jerusalem on a donkey. It's a triumphal entry. That is critical as well, because Daniel's prophecy is that from the starting point of this decree to rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince. The terminus has to have Messiah, the Prince. And it has not just Messiah, Messiah, the Prince. What is the declaration when Jesus rides into Jerusalem on the donkey? It's fulfillment of Zechariah 9:9 of the King has come. The Prince has arrived. And so it fits exactly with what Daniel's prophecy was talking about. Now look at verse 26. Now notice the events that Gabriel describes here are all things that occur after the 62 weeks, which is after the first period of 7 weeks, or you could say after the total period of 69 weeks, or 483 years. So what comes in this verse is after this has occurred. The first event, he says there in verse 26, occurs is that Messiah is going to be cut off and have nothing. That must be after the conclusion of the 69 weeks. Now, historically, we know that Jesus entered Jerusalem as Messiah the Prince, but before the week was over, what happened to him? He was crucified. The word cut off here, karath, means to kill or destroy. Jesus was killed, and he did not take his rightful position as the King of Israel at that time, did he? He's cut off. He doesn't gain anything at that time that was rightfully his as the promised Messiah who is king and supposed to gain David's throne, does he? And he will not gain those things until he returns. And when he does return, it's not as a sacrificial lamb. That was the first time. It's as the conquering king. And he will take up those things. The second event that Gabriel describes to Daniel is that the city and the sanctuary are destroyed. Now that brings into harmony Jeremiah's prophecies with Daniel's visions. There has been a restoration, as Jeremiah prophesied. Now he sees there's a coming destruction even further, as had been in Daniel's visions. There's this remnant, they go back, but eventually they're going to reject Messiah, and there's going to be a future judgment of the people in the land again. Now this future judgment would be by, it says, the people of the prince who is to come. Now historically, the Jewish people had a series of revolts against Rome in the first century, resulting in Roman general Titus arriving with his armies like a flood, and they surround the city and laid siege to it. And in 70 AD, he breaches the walls and he destroys the city. Absolutely levels it. That corresponds with Daniel's vision in Daniel 8 about the fourth beast, the future Roman kingdom. Then Gabriel says, following this, there's going to be war and desolations. The city is destroyed, but there will still be wars and desolations. It's a sad thing to think that Jerusalem, the Salem in it, it means peace. A city whose name actually has peace in it, it's had more than its fair share of wars. When we go back to 70 AD, it has been a constant battle over Jerusalem. And the Jewish people have not had much rest, have they? They have been wandering and they're persecuted wherever they go. Even to the present, Jerusalem's in turmoil, isn't it? There is constant terrorist attacks within the city. They blow up buses and restaurants and all sorts of things constantly. And the Jewish people are persecuted. This is continuing just as Daniel said it would. Now note here as well something else. The city and the sanctuary are destroyed by, it says, the people of the prince. But that the prince is one who is to come. The people destroyed Jerusalem, the temple in AD 70, are the Romans. And they belong to a prince that is yet still to come. Daniel would have understood this in terms of the prophecy concerning the fourth beast as recorded in Daniel 7. Daniel is told more about him in the next verse. Look at verse 27. He will make a firm covenant with the many for 1 week, but in the middle of the week he will put a stop to sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Now, while the previous verses have already have a definite fulfillment in history, there is nothing to indicate any of these things being fulfilled. Now, there are those who tried to force some kind of understanding that they've been fulfilled, but nothing works. Because actually, if you just continue to 70 weeks of years period, it ends before the destruction of Jerusalem. It doesn't work. It is not Antiochus Epiphanes, that's one of the claims that maybe he's the one that did this. He was long gone before Messiah arrived and was cut off and the city destroyed again. And neither is it Jesus. Some have proposed that. Yes, Jesus' death puts an end to the legitimacy of Jewish sacrificial system. But the sacrifices continued until the temple was destroyed in 70 AD. So none of that fits. These are things that must occur after the first 69 weeks of years and the events that follow those immediately, including Messiah being cut off and the destruction of Jerusalem, the temple. But they're events that are still future for us. These are events that correspond with Daniel 8, 24 and 25. Remember, Gabriel is explaining what to Daniel? The vision. The vision that he'd had previously, that's Daniel 7, or Daniel 8. And he records about this fourth beast. There would be another horn that would arise out of the ten, which would usurp three, and then would speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints for a time, times, and half a time. That is the future Antichrist. I think that's 7:24, not 8. So there's a time gap then between the 69th week and its conclusion and the beginning of this 70th week. Now, when does this 70th week of years begin? Well, the text is very clear. It says when he makes a firm covenant with the many. Who's the he? Well, the immediate antecedent is the people of the prince that destroyed Jerusalem. That's not the Jews. That's not Jesus. That's this future Antichrist. It's when this Antichrist makes a firm covenant with the many. The many here are the Jews. It's not the church. It's not some other group. Because that's who it's all talking about. The 70 weeks concerns who? The people and the holy city of Daniel. Jews in Jerusalem. So it's simply wrong, again, to try to place the church in this passage. The church is neither the subject nor in view in any of Daniel's visions. Now, whatever else is part of this covenant, and I'm sure there will be a lot of elements, this one thing is going to be there. It's going to be one of the elements. It allows the Jewish nation to rebuild the temple and resume the sacrificial system. How do we know that? Because he's going to stop the sacrifices. You can't stop something that's never started. And the Jews are not going to be making sacrifices unless the temple is there. Will they? So whatever else is there, the temple will be rebuilt, the sacrifices will begin again. Now at present, the nation of Israel does not control the Temple Mount. Now they control Jerusalem, but they actually don't control the Mount. They have given that over to the Muslims. And they have not done anything to try and usurp that because they don't want to start a religious war. And they know as soon as they do something with the Dome of the Rock, that mosque that's on top of it, there's war going to break out. They know that. So they haven't done anything to usurp that. But that doesn't mean they're not prepared. It is my understanding that they already have everything ready to go, that when the opportunity comes, they can put a temple up very fast. Everything's prepared for it. And they will do so when the opportunity comes. But they're a wise nation. They're a small nation surrounded by large nations, a small population surrounded by a huge population that hate them. And so they're not going to provoke the war unless something else happens. Now, the covenant may allow that to happen. So whether the temple is built before this week or the covenant is made and then they build it, whatever happens, we do know the temple is rebuilt. The sacrifices are resumed. Now, how do we, again, we know that? It's because in the middle of the week, the sacrifices are stopped. Now, the future prince succeeds in deceiving the many, and it appears to be this wonderful blessing to the Jews at first. But there is a remnant that they're not deceived, and they're not going to join the covenant. For in the middle of the week, at the 3.5-year mark, he shows his true colors, and he breaks the covenant, and he forces the sacrifice and the grain offerings. They end. At that point, they realize this is a supreme betrayal, but it's too late. Daniel 8:25 states they were given to his hands for time, time, and half a time. They are yielded to him. And then corresponding to the stop of the sacrifice, the grain offerings, is going to be what Gabriel describes here as, on the wings of abominations will come one who makes desolate. Now, we do not know what exactly that will be. Other than this, it is going to be obvious, and it will be very evil. That's what we do know about it. The term wing refers to the pinnacle or extreme point of something. So this is the extreme point of an abomination. And that may be that the Antichrist is seeking worship of himself as God in the temple. That's worse than Antiochus Epiphanes sacrificing pigs to Zeus. He wants the worship of himself as God. Jesus referred to this in Matthew 24:15 through 16, actually through 22. But verses 15 and 16, Jesus said, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains." And he goes on why and how fast you need to flee. And don't pause. Just get out of there because it's going to be bad. How bad? Verse 21, Jesus describes it this way. "For then there will be great tribulation such as not occurred since the beginning of the world until now, nor ever shall." The next 3.5 years are more terrible than anything that has ever occurred before. How bad? In verse 24, Jesus even adds that if the days were not shortened, all flesh would perish. That's bad. Revelation 12:6 indicates that God is going to miraculously nourish for 1,260 days his people that fled Antichrist. Revelation 11 indicates that this time period corresponds to the holy city being trampled down for 42 months. 1,260 days, 42 months is 3.5 years, time times and half a time. That's the middle of the 70th week. Now, if Gabriel had stopped there, not only would Daniel have been in worse shape than the earlier visions, we would be in worse shape. We would be despondent. And everybody who read the passage would be despondent. Because now it looks like evil wins. But the passage doesn't stop there. Isn't that good? Amen. There's some nasty stuff coming. But it doesn't end here. There's a final desolation. And that concerns this future prince, this Antichrist. And he's going to have great power during the last half of the 70th week. And he's going to make things desolate. But the seventh year ends with his destruction. It says, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. God's wrath is poured out on this man and his followers to their complete destruction. And this judgment of destruction has been decreed. It will happen. So there's no question about it. It is already written down. It will happen. And it is going to happen just as the prophets in the Old Testament had said it would happen, as Jesus said it would happen, and as Revelation says it would happen. There's actually a lot of prophecies concerning it. It will happen. The Lord is going to return in triumph as King of Kings and Lord of Lords. He is going to put down man's rebellion. He will bring in the millennium. Revelation 19 and 20 speak about that in specific. Israel's rebellion is purged. There's a remnant that is saved just as prophesied. All the things that we started off there in verse 24 are fulfilled. They're all fulfilled at the end of the 70th week. So Gabriel had been sent to Dan to explain how the prophecies of Jeremiah and the visions of Daniel, how do these things fit together? The 70 years that Jeremiah had prophesied that Jerusalem would be desolated had come to an end. His prophecy that God would allow the exiles to return was now imminent. It could happen at any point in time. However, Daniel's visions included this future tribulation, desolations for the nation. Gabriel affirms both. Now, God is loving, and because he is loving, he is patient, he's long-suffering, he's merciful, he is gracious. But he's also holy, he is also just. And God will keep his promises. He's going to keep his word. He will keep his word to Jeremiah. The nation would continue to suffer in future judgment as had been revealed to Daniel. Why? Because of their rebellion in the future. And that news would have been hard to take, except at the end there's a final judgment that's going to allow the new covenant of Jeremiah to be ushered in. All Israel will be saved. Now the future doesn't always look bright, does it? Sometimes it's difficult. We know there's devastating times ahead. We can take that on a personal level. We can take that on a national level or a group level. There are tough things that are coming up. I mentioned Grace earlier. She's in a tough situation. The future doesn't look too bright, does it? We don't think a whole lot about for our own nation. The future doesn't necessarily look too bright unless you really like debt. I don't like debt. It doesn't look too bright for where we're heading as a power either. We're squandering ourselves. It doesn't look too bright when it comes to our morality as a nation. As the generation that's currently in their teens arises and takes over, I don't think we'll even recognize America. They don't have a sense of morality at all, or only a few do. And those who are teens know what I'm talking about because you're dealing with it every day in school. So it doesn't look good, does it? When we look at prophecies for the future, it doesn't look too good either. Because everything keeps pointing, there's going to be wrath. God's wrath is going to come. Why? We deserve it. And if that's all we looked at, we should be despondent. But that's not all there is there? Because there's something beyond it. When Jesus looked at the cross, he knew what it entailed. And yet for the joy set before him, he endured the cross. There's a lot of things we have to endure in this life. We suffer. Why do we suffer? Well, first of all, we're sinners. We suffer because of our own sin. Second, we suffer because of other people's sin. They do things to us. They run into the back of your fairly new car and injure your daughter and grandkids. Right, John? We suffer because of people's sin. They weren't paying attention. Pow. We suffer because we live in a sin-filled world. Our bodies don't work like they're supposed to. We're dealing with genetic load. We inherit things from our parents that aren't too good. As Liz pokes her dad, all my allergies come from you, Dad. Nah, you probably got a few from Mom's side too. They come from all over the place. I think Jamie's thinking that now, like, oh, I don't like this doctor's report. Now I'm allergic to all these things. Now what am I going to do? Now she's going around talking to everybody who has the same allergies. We don't like that. But there's something in the future, isn't there? And that's where Daniel's hope ends up. Our God is faithful. He is true to his word. His judgments, his wrath are tempered. They're tempered by his mercy and grace. Otherwise, we couldn't be here today, could we? It's his mercy and grace has allowed us to know something of himself, know something of salvation in Christ, and have a hope for the future. And so we can trust his promises to us of salvation from sin by grace through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, and we're assured of a future in heaven with the Lord for eternity because he's true to his word, every single aspect of it.